Welcome to the 66th episode of the Jewish Drinking Show. I'm your host, Rabbi Drew Kaplan. I'm very excited to welcome first-time guest, Rabbi Dan Margulies.
Thank you, Rabbi Drew.
My pleasure. So for those less familiar with Rabbi Margulies here, he is presently on the High School Judaics faculty at the Berman Hebrew Academy in Rockville, Maryland. And previously, he was the rabbi of the Riverdale Minyan in New York. He is a graduate of my alma mater. We are fellow graduates of Yeshivat Chovei Torah in New York City. And previously, he was a former Talmud faculty at the Jerusha Institute, and he got his undergrad degree at Columbia. He's a former Lions. Go Lions, right? Everybody has Lions pride out there in Columbia. He got his BA in chemical physics and mathematics and arithmetic, right?
Not so much arithmetic, mostly. When you get to college level math, arithmetic means something totally different. So,
all right. So I'm very excited because we are talking about Rambam, Mishneh Torah, and what Rambam wrote about Kiddush and Havdalah for Shabbos. So Shabbat happens literally every week, and we bring it in with Kiddush. We sanctify, we kick the Shabbat festivities off with Kiddush, and we close them out with Havdalah. I like to use baseball. I think of Kiddush as like the formal opening pitch, like it kicks things off. And then, you know, we have the closer, you know, kind of bringing your for the save for Havdalah. So chapter 29 in the Mishneh Torah for anybody keeping score at home. We're going to be talking about this because the thing is, and I know Rabbi Margulies will definitely mention something about this. Kiddush, yes, it really is with words, but it's a drinking topic because you can't have Kiddush without drinking. There are, of course, exceptions, just like there is everything in Judaism. There's exceptions, which we'll talk about.
Well, and you said the opening pitch, and I think even structurally, before we get into the text, it's fascinating to consider the way Rambam has Hilchot Shabbat laid out in 30 chapters, and the first 28 chapters are all what we would have normally thought of as the laws of Shabbat. And the last two chapters, chapter 29, is Kiddush and Havdalah. And then chapter 30 is all of the rabbinic rules about preparing for Shabbat and making sure that we have hot food to enjoy on Shabbat and things like that, what we call Kavod Shabbat and Oneg Shabbat. And it's really interesting to think about why he decided to arrange the flow of the text in that way. 28 chapters front load really the heavy hitting parts of the halacha. Kiddush is a lighter topic, and dividing the prohibitions of Shabbat from the positive requirements of Shabbat that he sneaks in at the end.
Thank you for that literary context. That's really important. It really does also say something about how Rambam positions Kiddush and Havdalah within the larger, at least literary and perhaps conceptual framework for Shabbat. Right. I just want to start us off. I know I already mentioned Kiddush and Havdalah, so I love the way that he wraps these two together as being the bookends, and that it's this experiential, one could call it a literary envelope, but I'm going to call it an experiential envelope of just as we bring in Shabbat with wine and with words, we also close it out also with wine and with words. It's a beautiful way of ritualizing the entry and departure of Shabbat.
Definitely. And one of the linguistic hooks, which is really based off of the Gemara that the Rambam is basing himself off of, but he employs it as well, is that the obligation of Kiddush and Havdalah is derived from the Pasuk Zachor Yom HaShabbat LeKadosho, that we have to remember Shabbat.
And in Exodus 20, right?
Yeah, exactly, in Shemot Perkah. And many of the times where the verb Zachor, to remember something, appears in the Torah, Chazal comes and through Midrash, explicate that doesn't just mean to remember something cognitively, but that you actually have to do
articulate
some sort of, you have to articulate, you have to lehazkir. Zachor becomes lehazkir. To remember becomes to mention. And so that's, for example, how do we get the obligation of Parashat Zachor to read the passage about the war with Amalek every spring? The same kind of thing. We're supposed to remember what Amalek did to us. Well, how do we do that? We have to articulate it. We have to explicate it. And so with the beginning of Shabbat, we're supposed to Zachor Shabbat. We're supposed to remember the significance of Shabbat and set it aside. Well, how do we do that? We actually have to formally declare the start of Shabbat and then the end of Shabbat when it's over. And there's something really powerful in the rabbinic understanding just of speech as well, which is what I'm thinking now about Masechet Nedarim, because I'm teaching it to my high schoolers. We're learning Mishnah. And the power of speech is really something which features so prominently in Chazal, that human speech, you have the power to declare something, to make something prohibited, to make something permissible. And Kiddush is sort of like that, and Havdalah is sort of like that, with starting and finishing.
Well, there was a lot of verbal power that the rabbis understood, a lot of power within speaking. I mean, you can see that in Peah, in Mishnah Peah, we're talking about Talmud Torah, and Tosefta Peah about Lashon Hara, that they are incredibly powerful. And same thing with vowels and oaths, right? Shavuot and Nedarim, they are also really powerful. And like you said, it's one thing, it's like it could just be in your head, a nice little intellectual exercise of remembering, but to bring it out into the world verbally is a semi-concrete way of doing it. And I think ultimately, and Rambam doesn't really mention it, but I think doing it over wine is a way to really concretize it and reify these words.
Well, it makes it very formal, especially in a society where wine would have been both in some classes very commonplace and for other classes scarce, mandating that every family have a glass of wine to start Shabbat and a glass of wine to end Shabbat and recite this formal declaration over the wine really does make it a significant event. It's the start of a formal dinner. The pageantry of the fancy dinner becomes incorporated with the mitzvah of Shabbat as well. And at the same time, the choice of wine becomes interesting. You know, we don't have time to go into all of it in depth right now, but like, is the wine actually a biblical requirement like the mitzvah of Kiddush itself to mention Shabbat? Is saying that over a glass of wine part of the biblical mitzvah? The Rambam says no. The Rambam seems to say pretty explicitly that the wine is something the rabbis added onto the biblical requirement to mention Shabbat at the start and the finish. So you could imagine a world where, you know, what if you don't have wine? What if you live in it, you know, you have nothing to say Kiddush over? Well, is there still the mitzvah to mention Shabbat verbally at start and finish as part of Tefillah? We do that. We mention Shabbat in Maariv. We mention Havdalah in Maariv. So in certain respect, you fulfill the mitzvah that way, but then you have this added rabbinic component to do so at the meal with a glass of wine, which totally changes the context. It's no longer a prayer context that you'd be doing in shul with a minyan. It's something you're doing in the home with your family.
It's interesting because in the Talmud, Rabbi Yochanan talks about how it depends upon the socioeconomic ability of the Jews at the time. They instituted it and they took it out. They, for both Kiddush and Havdalah, they put it in, but then they didn't have money, so they took it out and burbled back and forth. But yeah, that's how ultimately it's considered to be a rabbinic and not an intricate biblical performance of the mitzvah.
Right.
So Rambam really, and he's not wrong. I mean, he's basing himself off in this entire chapter, largely the Talmud. And he says, and really you can see it in Halacha 9, as well as 14 through 17, here in this 29th chapter of the Mishnah Torah, he says, really, like the overriding principle is really it's only wine that's fit for libations on the altar, with some exceptions, right? There's some exceptions, as well as, we did mention drinking. You can do, and he picks this up from what Rav did in the 10th chapter of Pesachim in the Talmud, of sometimes Rav felt like having bread for Kiddush instead of wine, and then sometimes he did it over wine, and then he also sometimes would do Kiddush on beer, which is an entirely separate topic. So that's what Rambam says. You can do Kiddush over bread, but you cannot do Havdalah over bread. And then he also says you can do Havdalah over beer, but not Kiddush over beer. So you have options. You literally have options. So well, it's Friday night, you can do wine or bread, and then Saturday night, you can do beer or wine.
Well, it tells us that there are two components of the significance of wine in their rabbinic thinking. There's wine as part of a formal meal, and there's wine as a significant alcoholic beverage. And so Havdalah, it seems like the focus on is on having an alcoholic beverage, a beverage of some status. Mm-hmm. And Friday night, where you're about to start your Sudat Shabbat, about to have Friday night dinner, the emphasis is on starting a formal meal. So if you're not having wine, you have to sort of formally declare the bread to be the centerpiece of the meal instead.
I think part of it, though, is that there is literally zero precedent in the Talmud for anybody making Havdalah over bread. No one, that never comes up. It never happens. So Rambam just figures it's not in the realm of possibility. Right. Beer, although it pops up here and there as little opinions in the 10th chapter of Pesachim in the Babylonian Talmud as an option to do Kiddush over beer, ultimately that is squashed by the preference for wine over beer. And so that's why he really doesn't permit it, not even for Kiddush, not even for daytime Kiddush, just the one exception for Havdalah, which owing to this interesting story that took place in Babylonia.
And you mentioned Halacha Yudalad, so now I want to go on a little bit of a tangent about which types of wine can you use, because this is a place where the Halacha, as the Rambam presents it, is certainly not in consonance with common practice today, at least in most communities. And that is, the Rambam says in Halacha Yudalad, based off of the Gemara Masechet Bava Batra, Ein mekadshin el ha'yayin ha'ra'uy le'naseich al gabei ha'mizbeach. The wine has to be suitable to have been brought as a libation on the altar in the temple. And the Rambam then cites that. And then he says, V'yesh mi shematir lekadesh. He says, there are those opinions, and he's referencing the opinion of the Balei HaTosfot. The Ravid also seems to agree with this, as well as some other of the Rishonim, that it's only to exclude a certain subcategory of wines which are disqualified from the altar, but other ones which would not be suitable for the altar would be suitable for Kiddush. Most notably, this is the machloket around Yain Mevushal, which is in the time of the Talmud probably really did refer to wine which had been brought to a boil in an open pot. And wine that had been brought to a boil in an open pot, the Rambam, the Gaonim, say the bracha should be shehakol. It's totally disqualified from being wine anymore. You imagine it would totally destroy the flavor of a fine bottle of wine, something like that. And at the same time, that also exempts it from the prohibitions of wine which has been handled by non-Jews or produced by non-Jews and things like that. And so, because it's not wine anymore, but in Ashkenaz, where there were more non-Jews, maybe the non-Jews were involved in the wine production more, I'm not sure, the historical piece, you know, Chaim Soloveitchik has a whole thing about that. There are people much more knowledgeable about the history than I am. But the opinion develops that actually, you could use Yain Mevushal, boiled wine, for Kiddush. And of course, nowadays, many of our Mevushal wines have been flash pasteurized in a way which damages the flavor much less, but they're marketed as Yain Mevushal. So you get the leniency of that non-Jews handling the wine doesn't disqualify, make it non-kosher. And at the same time, according to this other opinion of Balei HaTosfot and other Rishonim, that the wine could be used for Kiddush. The Rambam thinks that wine is shahakol. If it really counts as mevushal, then it's shahakol. You can't use it for Kiddush. It's totally disqualified. But most of our communities, I think, rely on that opinion that you're in that safe middle zone where you avoid the prohibitions and you can still use it for Kiddush.
It is interesting, but he's quoting from the Talmud about the, you can even take a cluster of grapes, squeeze it, and then use that as Kiddush, which is funny because you're not allowed to do that for libation on the altar, but it's a Kiddush, it's an innovation of Rava there in that discussion above a Basra, which is such a fascinating move on Rava's part. Like, you don't even need alcohol. You can just squeeze grapes and Kiddush on it. Right. Like, wow.
Then and Rambam again, very commonplace nowadays for people to rely on use of non-alcoholic grape juice for Kiddush and Havdalah in all sorts of contexts. I have two Gedolim stories about rabbis in Yerushalayim, one about Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank and one about Rav Yehoshua Neuwirth, who is the author of Shmirat Shabbat Kilchata. So Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, supposedly, the story was that he was in shul Friday night and he was chatting with one of the fellows from the neighborhood, and he said, I'm very excited, I'm about to go home and fulfill what it says in the Gemara Bava Batra, so chet adam esh kol shel anavim mishalav yushayom. I'm going to go squeeze a cluster of grapes and say Kiddush over it. And Rav Frank realized that this man was planning to squeeze the grapes to make the grape juice on Shabbat, and he no, you're not allowed to squeeze the grapes on Shabbat. You have to squeeze them before Shabbat starts because of the bracha of Sochet, of Dash. And the story of Rav Neuwirth, fascinating that because of his involvement in so many, serious halachic questions that come up about people with medical conditions or people who've been in the hospital and things like that, he insisted that at his Seder, he always used grape juice so that he would not become intoxicated and be unable to answer people's halachic questions, because the prohibition to issue a halachic ruling while intoxicated, he wanted to make sure that even into late at night on Pesach night, you can imagine on Yom Tov how many people are coming with halachic questions. But he imagined being close to the hospital and people knew that he was available. They would come to his home to ask shilas, and he had to be available for that, which is incredible mesiras nefesh on his part to fulfill the mitzvah in a somewhat less than ideal way in order to keep himself available as a resource to the community, which I think is very inspiring to me.
Wow. Staying on the beverage piece, I do want to talk about, I did mention earlier the beer for Havdalah. So it is interesting the way that Rambam formulates this, the allowance for beer at Havdalah, which is not the way that everybody, not all of his contemporaries formulate the allowance for beer to be used at Havdalah. It's not a blanket statement, whereas bread, it's really just up to the desire and the just sort of the whim of the person doing Kiddush for Friday night. But Havdalah, there's a little bit more of an objective standard versus the bread is entirely a subjective standard. I feel like bread tonight, right? Whereas beer.
Which is so fascinating because I feel like nowadays, if you would ask people, mm-hmm. very few people are familiar with the halacha that you could say Kiddush Friday night over bread. I know of almost no one who ever would avail themselves of that option. And it's totally preference. Mitaveh, if you prefer, if you're really hungry, you prefer to have the bread right away, whatever it is, go for it. And the allowance for Hamar Medina, for the local wine, which is a euphemism for other alcoholic drinks or other beverages that are consumed in that locale instead of wine or in higher proportions of wine.
Everybody, because humans drink alcohol wherever they live. That's just a human reality, right? Whether it's vodka in Russia, it's beer in Germany, it's wine in France. Every land has its alcohol. Or who knows, maybe brandy or some sort of Kirschfass or wherever you may live, right?
And Shlivovitz. And the Rambam ties it to the locale, right? Some of the other poskim sort of create this two-tiered ranking. There's wine and then there's everything else, other alcoholic drinks. And the Rambam does emphasize that the term the Talmud uses is Chamar Medina, or as he calls it, Chamar Medina Yeina, the wine of that locale, Medina Sherov Yeina Shechar, a city, a locale, a country where the majority of the wine is beer, meaning he's using wine, more as broadly, the alcohol.
As a metonym or a catch-all phrase for all alcoholic beverages.
So in a place where, like America, where they drink more, we drink more beer than wine on average, then beer is elevated sort of to the semi-wine status.
Right, which is just like in Sasanian Persia, where the Babylonian Talmud, they were more of a beer country versus Israel. Israel is and has been, and probably always will be, a wine country, just like France, just like Italy. Those are wine countries.
Whereas, it depends on the soil, depends on the climate, what kinds of crops grow better. Mesopotamia, of course, is an ideal growing region for grain. It's a flat, fertile land. Israel is rocky and mountainous, so you grow grapevines because they'll grow anywhere. which I feel like is so much of the symbolism around grapevines in Tanakh as well, right? The Jewish people are regularly compared to a grapevine planted in a vineyard, which is, again, we're hardy, we'll survive even through difficult times. And when cultivated, when tended, cared for, we flourish very nicely. When we're struggling, we I don't know if anybody here has a hands-on experience with grapevines, but if they get plenty of rain and plenty of sunshine, they do wonderfully well. And if nobody's watching out, bugs come, various kinds of fungi come and attack, and they don't do so well.
So I think this is compared to some of the contemporary opinions, this is a fairly low bar, fairly low standard to hurdle over, because some of the contemporaries argue that you can't find wine even within a day's traveling, or no grapes are grown within a day's, whatever it is, travel or whatever the length is. Whereas he says, it can be grown there. You can easily find it, but it's just a majority. We're just talking about quantity of alcohol sold, which is a much, much lower bar to hurdle over for the rum, which I think is great, especially as a beer person. Like, yes.
Right. And he says, mutar, it's allowed. You're allowed to avail yourself of that choice. There may be reasons why people would prefer wine over beer for Havdalah or for Kiddush HaRabba, the Shabbat morning Kiddush, which we haven't even really gotten to yet, because that's later on in the chapter. but there definitely have been times in Jewish history where, because of scarcity, and the cost involved, obviously, you know, imagine in Northern Europe, where grape wine was incredibly scarce. You know, people relied on the permission to use raisin wines and things like that, and dilute them with water and all sorts of things. It's mostly just the sugar and water with a couple raisins tossed in and left to ferment. And so to be able to use grain spirits, vodka, whiskeys, things like that, for Shabbat morning Kiddush and then for Havdalah, became a very commonplace. And then the controversy that erupted became developed to be around actually what quantity would you have to use. It seems clear from most of the halachic sources you would still have to use what we normally think of as the standard size cup, a revi'it, which is around 3.5 ounces or something like that. Mm-hmm. And for some hard liquor, that starts to get to be quite a large drink to be having at 11 o'clock in the morning before you've had your herring. And so,
but it's very doable.
Depends on
the person.
Depends on the person. And of course, you said there are some Rishonim who took a much more stringent stance on Chamer Medina. Mm-hmm. In recent years and in certain times and places, there have been poskim who have taken a much, much more lenient stance about what constitutes Chamer Medina. So we've been talking about alcoholic beverages, but there are many prominent poskim who have discussed what about tea and coffee, what about even things like milk and orange juice and soda, which are beverages which have a very low significance, cultural status in the society, but they're not water. At least they're not water.
Right. And you know, it's interesting thing about the Rambam's formulation and talking about yena, about it's wine, right? And we wouldn't even consider tea or Diet Coke or anything of that sort.
Right.
To even be considered wine or alcoholic at all.
There is a friend and colleague who mentioned to me when if you would imagine a celebratory event, some kind of, you know, celebration, some kind of holiday party, something, but that alcoholic drinks weren't allowed. So what would you use to replace the alcoholic beverages? You would have some kind of fancy mocktails, you know, juices, sparkling juices with
sparkling apple juice, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Some kind of thing, sparkling cider, whatever. Yeah. Now, what do? We get the Concord grape, dark purple one. You know, you give, like, in the non-Jewish world, grape juice is like for little kids, and it's like it's in a juice box, right? It's not anything of any real cultural thing, but it's wine because we value grape grapes. So grape juice for us is like a kind of a wine. And it doesn't click in our minds with the same kind of cultural significance that other things might. And certainly alcoholic beverages, we have a clear, continuous chain of culture, not only in Jewish society, but in other societies, that an alcoholic beverage is part of what makes something a fancy event or a significant encounter, a business deal or a date. You get a glass of wine with your dinner or a beer with dinner, or go out for drinks. And there is some significance to that, which of course, in terms of the social aspect, there are other halacha about that. That's in other parts of Shulchan Aruch and everything, but you know, you have a whole podcast, so I'm not going to
say. I was going to say, that's like another 5 episodes. Like, wow, I'm just thinking about all that content. Like, that's a good one. That's a good one.
I hope you've been enjoying this episode so far. Here's a sneak peek into next week's episode featuring Dr. Rivka Press-Schwartz.
Broadly in our community, less marijuana use, less vaping than the national average, which I think I don't know if we would have expected that, but more binge drinking, I know I didn't expect that.
I want to pick up less vaping than and marijuana use than you had expected.
I hope you enjoyed that sneak peek into next week's episode, which I hope you come back and watch or listen. And now back to this episode.
What's really fascinating for me, I love approaching really anything with asking the 5 W's and H, who, what, when, where, why, and how. Now, one of the really interesting things that the Rambam doesn't bring up is the who, right? He doesn't talk about differentiating between men and women. He doesn't talk about ages. So that's one of the, I'm not going to get into that, but he just doesn't talk about that in this chapter. The what, as far as drinking wine, he does talk about. When is where we're at, and I wanted to talk about that. So when it's really with, like, Kiddush is when the sun sets, and Havdalah is kind of, I mean, he doesn't get into the details of exactly when Havdalah occurs, but let's just for this particular conversation's sake, it's when Shabbat ends. Right. And one of the really fascinating things, I'm going to say two quick things. One is he does mention in he mentions in Halacha 5 that there's a prohibition against eating or drinking once Shabbat comes in or Shabbat departs, that you're like cut off. You really need to make Kiddush or Havdalah, and other, you're like, your consumption is locked. You need to stop consuming until you do Kiddush and Havdalah, and then you can unlock, and then you can go back into your eating or drinking. And then
and that's a characteristic of many other mitzvot that take place in the evening. That is holding off on the evening meal until you've performed the mitzvah that's on your to-do list. So that applies to Hanukkah candles, reading the Megillah on Purim, B'dikat Chametz on Erev Pesach. I'm trying to think of another example right now. It's blanking on me.
You're saying that lines up
davening mar, right? Davening mar, you're not supposed to eat dinner until you've had a chance to daven first. So there is a sense that, and Sefirah HaOmer, according to some opinions, I think also. So there is a notion that it's a way to make sure you don't forget about the mitzvah. Mm-hmm. You have to take care of this to-do list before you can sit down to your dinner, and then you get distracted and you fall asleep.
A safeguard.
Right.
It's a safeguard. And he also develops this a little bit more in 12 and 13, when he talks about what if you are in a meal, or, and this is definitely very relevant to listeners of JewishDrinking.com, what if you're in a drinking session, right? What if you're just having it, like you're sharing some whiskeys or beers, and Shabbos happens, you gotta stop your drinking, or at least say Kiddush, and then you can continue your drinking session, which is, by the way, we're recording this in the winter. This is very relevant. I know I'm drinking, I'm pre-Shabbosing, I've got some beers going, and then once sunset hits, I know I have to stop drinking until I can say Kiddush. Once I say Kiddush,
it's 2 p.m.
When, you know,
it's probably more common, I would think, in the summer around Havdalah time. So you imagine you're in a vacation setting, maybe you're at the beach, someplace warm. You're sitting out enjoying a leisurely Sudash Lishit late into the evening, and you've had a couple of glasses of wine or something like that. You're watching the sunset, and then it gets to be time for Havdalah. You could imagine something like that as well, where you have the wine right in front of you. You already said the bracha, sort of what's the context there. But so, you mentioned about
the So that's sort of the interrupting, and then you have the unlock. But, and this is probably what you're, actually, I'm going to say one other thing, then I'm going to get to the exciting part for, I think, what you're going to say. The other thing that he mentions in the 10th halacha is about Kiddusha Rabbah, the great Kiddush, which is the Saturday morning Kiddush, which is actually smaller. And then he says, yeah, we do it for that too. But the really cool thing that he does, that he says, is in the 11th halacha, which is that there's something to it to actually temporally advance doing Kiddush, and not just Kiddush, Havdalah as well. So even before sunset, even before Shabbat arrives, you can do Kiddush. And really fascinatingly, even before Shabbat ends, and not only before Shabbat ends, before the sun sets on Saturday afternoon, there is something to doing Havdalah without the fire, but there is something to be said about that, which I thought was like, it's one thing for the Kiddush part, but even the Havdalah, to do an early Havdalah before sunsetting.
Well, I think so many people have in their mind this assumption that it's Havdalah that makes Shabbat over, which is really not true. Havdalah, for the Rambam especially, based on how much he emphasized it, Havdalah is a way of marking the end of Shabbat, of noticing and articulating that Shabbat has ended or will end soon. Mm-hmm. And so the fulfillment of the mitzvah of Havdalah, to recite Havdalah, is really separate from anything to do with the permission to do malacha after Shabbat has ended. And so, again, it's sort of this cultural association we have that, like, okay, like, wait, we're going to say Havdalah now, and then Shabbat is finished. But Shabbat is over when it's over, right?
Yeah.
And there's a mitzvah of Tosefet Shabbat to add onto Shabbat to maintain the prohibitions of Shabbat beyond the formal cutoff point. Mm-hmm. The Rambam may disagree exactly about the parameters of Tosefet Shabbat. That's, again, another topic to for another time. So interesting to think about. Number one, like starting Shabbat early or saying Kiddush early for Shabbat, Friday afternoon, and then saying Havdalah early on Shabbat afternoon, as long as it's into the evening, you know, it's after Plag HaMincha or something. He doesn't even say that explicitly, does he? He just sort of says
near sunset. The end of Shabbat.
Be Yitziato, as it's ending, which really does emphasize that it's this a recognition and a declaration about the sanctity of the day and the significance of the difference between Shabbat and the rest of the week, and not really about letting you do malacha again.
We've talked about who, the what, the we actually didn't talk about the where, but really quickly in Halacha A, he says it needs to be in the place of the meal. So that's the who, what, the when, the where, the why we mentioned, you mentioned, with Zechor Et Yom HaShabbos L'Kadsho, to make mention of the Sabbath day to sanctify it. And that leaves us really with just one more question, which is how, right? And so this is dealt with in the seventh halacha.
There's some interesting details here, which people may not be necessarily aware of. Rambam mentions, this is based on the Gemara Masechet Brachot, that you take a cup, it has to hold the minimum size. There's a whole article about, you know, how the minimum size may have changed over different communities and different times and places, how we measure the revi'it. That's, again, a topic for another time. And you actually have to wash the cup. The Rambam emphasizes medicho mi bifnim. You have to wash it on the inside, bishotfo mi bachutz, and wash it on the outside. And that's kind of like the formal, almost ritualized washing, like make sure the cup is clean, fine. But it's also about designating this cup as significant kosh shel bracha. It's going to be used for bracha, it's going to be used for a mitzvah. And
what's fascinating is where it's taken from in the Talmud is a discussion of the cup of blessing for the Birchat HaMazon, and as opposed to necessarily a catch-all for any cup used for any sort of blessing. But the Rambam understands that kosh shel bracha as a blessing cup, well, for any blessing.
Right.
And here it's for the Kiddush blessing, and therefore those parameters apply to, or guidelines of practice apply to here, both the rinsing inside, the washing outside, you know, that stuff.
And then, of course, to actually drink the wine, which is interesting because there are other Rishonim with other opinions about actually how much do you really have to drink the wine or not. Is it about reciting the Kiddush over the cup of wine, but not necessarily drinking it? We didn't mention this until now, but what if someone is a Nazir? What if someone has taken a vow not to, which includes the prohibition to drink wine?
Which sounds like a really fantastic topic in the future to talk about Rambam on Nazir.
Yes.
You mentioned the measurements, the quantities. Rambam does mention the cup should contain a ravit, so we'll just call it 3 to 4 ounces of wine. And then, but you don't need to drink all of it. He just says you need to drink a cheeksful. And then for all the rest, you can provide to the other, your fellow diners for Kiddush.
Well, that's another interesting aspect of Kiddush, which again, if you're thinking about like, okay, you're fulfilling the mitzvah, you drink the wine because you said the bracha.
Yeah.
And mashke l'kol b'nei chabura, sharing the wine with the other people at the table, is that part of the mitzvah? Is that just being generous and you know, being a good host, sharing, like what is the point of sharing the wine with others? I feel like there's a cultural context that maybe we're not totally aware of, or some expectation. I mean, hospitality.
For just the host to drink the wine, you should share. It's for everybody. And also there's a certain sense that the person who is doing the Kiddush is doing on behalf of everybody, the fellow diners. So they should share in the Kiddush and share in the blessing as well.
Right. We're so conscious of germs and shared utensils these days that we have to think back to a time before people were so aware of that, think about what they're doing. Oh, and then one other aspect which we didn't touch on until now, but is of course an important detail, is that the Kiddush has to be recited b'mekom se'uda, that the wine is not, you can't just drink wine by itself, it has to be part of a meal. And of course that leads to all sorts of interesting developments, like the custom to have Kiddush in the synagogue Friday night, which developed in a time and place when guests in the community or people who didn't have a place to stay would sleep in the synagogue. That practice continues, even though most synagogues no longer house guests or house people who have nowhere else to stay. We could think about that as an important piece of our tzedakah mindset as well. But then, of course, the outgrowth of having a kiddush, colloquial kiddush on Shabbat morning, in order to allow you to say Kiddush in the morning after Shabbat services, to host a brunch, a luncheon, a snack, depends on which shul you go to, what it looks like. But it's fascinating to consider that one small halacha becomes a whole cultural outgrowth of, you know, the types of foods we consume and the social camaraderie that comes along with it, which is such an integral part of how the synagogue space functions as a social center for the Jewish community, and is really such a small tangential halachic detail which gets blown out of proportion.
I mean, one person's blown out of proportion is another person's, this is so great that we could have this part of our culture.
Well, as a former shul rabbi, I'll tell you that the Kiddush clubs, you know, not always on the best terms with management.
Which is also a topic of a previous episode.
For whatever reason, I remember learning this with my rabbi when I learned this halachot first, you know, years ago in Halacha Chet, about the Kiddush b'mekom suda. This is, again, something that people may not know or may not be aware of. It comes up in camp settings, Shabbaton settings, all sorts of things. And also just imagine, what if you want to have your Kiddush and then you want to have like hors d'oeuvres a little bit first or something first before sitting down to the meal. The Rambam actually addresses, Kidesh bezavit zo, ochel bezavit shnia. As long as you're still in the same building or in the same house, to have said Kiddush in one place, you can move around the house. It doesn't have to be at the table. I mean, some other posts can maybe take it more formally.
Wait, the Rambam does mention that?
The Rambam says in Halacha Chet, Im kidesh bezavit zo, ochel bezavit shnia. You can move to the other side of the room, the other side of the house. So you can imagine. And the culture of the time of Chazal, certainly, they would stand up in one room and drink their first glass of wine and have their salad course. And then they would enter into the dining room and lie down in order to have the main meal. And so recognition of the actually, you know, fancy dinner party, you want to have hors d'oeuvres and appetizers, wait for some people to arrive. Of course, you don't want them to miss Kiddush, but to schmooze for a while, to mingle for a while before you sit down to the meal. And I feel like so many of our Shabbat dinners are structured on this very formal opening. You sit down, you have Kiddush, you wash your hands, you have hamotzi, and then the schmoozing starts. Why not schmooze first for a while and get to know each other, do the icebreakers, whatever it is. It's more casual opening to the start of the meal, at least according to some authorities, has a halachic stamp of approval.
That's really cool. Thank you so much for joining the show, Rabbi Margulies.
It's a joy, as I mentioned before, to be able to study Torah with esteemed colleagues is always a joy and a pleasure. And thank you, Rabbi Drew, for having me on the show.
All right. My pleasure. And l'chaim.
L'chaim.